This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Telos and the Telos HX Digital Hybrids. Telos has reinvented the digital hybrid with the HX1 and the HX2, offering more features and less costs. Sounds better and works harder, but it's easy to configure and simple to install. Check it out on the web at telos-systems.com/HX.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
I've been doing it for 30 years, although, quite frankly, there aren't nearly enough people doing what I'm doing today. Go ahead.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
You probably know him, you probably love him. Mark Persons is here, along with Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello there, I'm Kirk Harnack. Very glad to be back in the USA after a couple weeks gone. Thanks very much to Tom Ray for filling in for the hosting duties. I appreciate that a whole lot. And I'm real sorry I missed the live interview with Tom Hartnett last week. But hey, anyway, you've tuned in this week to This Week in Radio Tech. This is the show where we talk about what's happening in audio, in RF, in everything that happens from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower in the radio biz. And that includes lots of other audio subjects as well, but we try to confine it to what's happening around a radio station, since we deal with audio and metadata about audio all the time. Well, myself, I am the international and domestic. I'm the big sales cheese at Telos Omni and Axia. My main job is to help educate people about new technology that Telos and Omni and Axia are doing. So that's my full-time job. And also with us are a couple of our usual co-hosts today. First of all, the best-dressed engineer in radio. It's from Manhattan, Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you? I'm a broadcast technologist at the CBS radio stations here in New York City. 3 AMs, 3 FMs, and we have a great time broadcasting from the Big Apple.
And also with us from Muckwanago, Wisconsin, it's Chris Tarr. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. I'm Chris. I'm the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin. And go Packers.
When's that game happen? Is that a week and a half from our recording date?
The game will be a week from this coming Sunday. So we're recording this on Wednesday, so a week and a half.
All right. And if I get the thing edited and pushed out anytime soon, it'll still be more than a week away. So thanks for being on the show, guys. And also, we have with us a special guest. This is a gentleman who I have known for years and years and years and years and years. And first met Mark Persons. Was it through Sign Systems, or maybe did I meet you at an NAB show?
Probably too many years ago, actually, but that's another story unto itself.
Probably was. So, Mark, you are a contract engineer in Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, that's right. Actually, I've been doing it for 30 years, and I grew up in broadcasting. My father started in broadcasting in the 1920s, and he somehow got me into it, and I just don't know where to stop. And I there's an interesting point to this whole thing, and that is that I actually feel like it's an obligation for me to go out and actually do broadcast engineering, because that really is my life. It's the only thing I have done in my life.
Whoa. And, you know, actually for most of us, that's just about true, except for, you know, throwing papers and being on the radio a little bit. That's all I've done until the folks at Telos hired me. Now, Mark, you got some experience. Well, you said your dad was in radio. He was an engineer. Do you ever think about your dad getting you into broadcasting and broadcast engineering? When you do you think, thanks, Dad? Or do you think, thanks, Dad?
Yeah, really. So which one of the two is it? Well, he started out as an engineer, and they grew a regional network. It was out of Duluth, Minnesota. It was called the Arrowhead Radio Network. They must have had 15 or 18 radio stations, and it got to him. What happened was he had to stop doing broadcast or stop doing the corporate job because he was he was burned out. So we wound up building a radio station when I was a kid. In 1959 at Ely, Minnesota, WELY Radio, which later on Kuralt owned. Charles Kuralt had that one. And then we moved on and built another one. And I remember building the one in Brainerd, Minnesota, where I'm at right now, 1964, while I was in high school. And I left for a few years to be in the Army and then came back. And I've always been an engineer. It's what I do. So being in ownership just doesn't do it for me. It's got to be the real thing. It's got to be broadcast engineering.
So, Mark, you do what most of us know as contract engineering, right? You're not full time employed by any one station, are you? You're probably on retainer or charged by the hour to go build mm-hmm. stations and fix existing ones.
Yeah, actually, I charge by the hour. I don't have any actual contracts, except they're moral contracts with the radio stations involved. So I just when they call, I go, and if they don't pay their bills, I never go back.
You know, this business of contract engineering—that's what I was in when you and I met, and I remember pretty clearly. I got out of contract engineering in late 1995, early 96. And shortly thereafter, the Telecom Act of 96 was signed into law. And when I checked back with I went to work for Scott Studios in Dallas. And when I checked back with a lot of my former customers around the Memphis, Tennessee area, I discovered that, you know, the job that I had been doing for them kind of got gobbled up as stations consolidated and they took you know, a full-time engineer from a couple of stations, maybe dropped one of them and added to their assignments stations that I used to do engineering mm-hmm. for. So my point is that had I stayed in contract engineering through the late 1990s, I think I might have had a hard time, you know, putting food on the table. Yet you have continued through contract engineering for a long, long time. Tell me about that. What that Telecom Act of 96 did. Did it affect your business? And how have you seen your contract engineering business change through the years up to now?
Okay, well, it really has evolved. I got into it when the FCC deregulated the requirement to have an engineer at every radio station, and it just seemed like the right thing because there weren't enough engineers around to take care of all of these AM, FMs, and that's all they were an AM and an FM, and that was considered the whole thing, unless you were a really big owner and you might have another AM, FM that's 200 miles away or something like that. But really, that's what it was. And there was such a shortage of engineers at the time that was what I really had to do. When stations consolidated, that was a shock for me too. Actually, it didn't hurt because there were so few people doing what I'm doing that I just kept right on doing it. And it wasn't a problem. Although, quite frankly, there aren't nearly enough people doing what I'm doing today. Go ahead.
Ah, okay. You find yourself in more demand than you can handle the work?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm having trouble trying to figure out this camera thing. So anyway, the truth is that I was way overbooked up until a couple of years ago, and then the economy hit big time. And we wound up with a situation where our income dropped dramatically during that. But it was okay because I was now back to where I wanted to be anyway. So it's actually worked out okay.
Hey, Chris Tarr, you wanted to mention something in here. You two are almost in the same part of the country. You're one state apart from each other. Chris?
We are, absolutely. It's funny because I've sort of crossed his path many times. We've actually never met, but I can certainly vouch for what he's saying. And I think, especially in our part of the country, that very much is the case, where there's a lot of stations that can't afford or don't have a full-time engineer. We've got, you've got these situations where after deregulation, these engineers, and not only that, but as you know, there's the attrition. You know, these engineers are getting older, they're retiring, and they're not getting replaced by the owners of the radio stations. So even with a full-time job, I still, you know, weekends and sometimes late at night when there's an emergency with some of the smaller stations around here, I jump in and I go and I take care of things that need to get taken care of. And a lot like Mark, it's in my blood. I can't say no when somebody calls and, you know, they're in the middle of an emergency. I feel like I have to get up and give them a hand. But it really has been, and it's something to think about in the future too. There are a lot of these radio stations out there that are counting on guys like Mark and guys like me and guys, you know, there are a lot of guys around that are doing this. So just be kind of on call and drop by and kind of be their savior. So, you know, there's a lot to do with that. And I think that, you know, I think as time goes on, there's going to be a greater need for that just based on the fact that there's more and more contract engineers who are retiring and just engineers in general who are retiring and not as many people coming into the business. So it'll be interesting to see here in the next several years how that all pans out.
Hey, I got a couple questions for Mark here, kind of a first one and then a follow-up. Mark, you got some electronics training, what, in the Army or in the Air Force? Which one?
Oh, actually, it was the Army, but I was an instructor in the Army. The truth was that I started training myself as a kid. My dad helped. But basically, when I was a preteen, I already knew Ohm's Law and all of the things that I needed to do to get the job done. All I did was just propel myself further into broadcast and learn everything I could. And the interesting part about being a contractor is I get to see new equipment all the time, probably to the point where I maybe don't want to see any more new equipment. But the point is that I go to a radio station and there's a problem. So I go there and say, well, I've seen that before. It's this. And then I fix it. And it all seems so seamless to the clients. The truth is that I know of some other younger guys out in the field. And what happens is they don't understand the problem. They haven't seen it before. And they develop these huge stories about, oh, gosh, it took this and this and this and this to fix it. And in the end, that they're heroes is what they are. But the problem is they could have fixed it in 2 hours, but they took 2 days to fix it.
Yeah. So here's the follow on is I've as a fellow contract engineer, you know, I learned and taught myself enough. I didn't have any formal education, but I taught myself enough to actually become pretty good at broadcast systems. And then, Mark, I found out that you actually designed some products. Maybe you still do, but you designed products, some audio products, small consoles and a few other things. I think of the Zircon line. And then you also got involved with a bit more complicated things, things that some engineers consider almost black magic. And this would be like designing and building AM diplexers to, you know, put two AM signals into one tower. Tell us about, you know, how you gained knowledge, experience, and then got into design of audio circuits and then RF circuits.
Well, audio circuits are really easy. And I'm really good at AM because, gosh, I love AM. That's where the world started out. That's where I started in broadcast. FM came later. But really, when it comes to AM directionals, I leave the design of those to other people. But interestingly enough, I was just involved in a project at Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. Four AMs on the same set of seven towers, all of them directional day and directional night. Can you believe that? It may
with different
be the biggest
patterns, I'm sure, and different combinations of towers they were using.
Different combination. Yeah, if some stations would use two during the day, some they might use four at night. It's just a complete mixed bag. Yeah. But they were actually directional.
I was going to say, I know Mark Mueller, and I saw some of the pictures from that build, and it's amazing with that diplex system, the ATUs for each of the towers. You know, each ATU is divided up into sections for each station, and that was a really, you guys did a fantastic job on that. That was some amazing engineering that happened there.
Well, actually, it's a Mark Mueller design. And I just participated in putting it all together, and it's pretty exciting, too. So think about it this way. Let's say you had two radio stations into a single tower, okay? So what do you need? Well, you need an antenna coupling network for each one of the two radio stations to go into the tower. And each one needs a filter to filter out the other station and let yours through. So that means that the two stations each need to have one filter. So that's two filters going to one tower. Now, let's assume that you're talking about three radio stations. Well, now, each one of the radio stations has to have two filters between its antenna coupling network and the tower. You're going to filter out one unwanted station coming into that antenna coupling network, and you're going to filter out a second radio station coming into that antenna coupling network. So now we're talking four filters for, now you're actually talking six filters for three radio stations, and that's a single tower. Now let's take it to four radio stations. Now each one of those radio stations has to have three filters between it and the tower. And now we also have as seven towers. We're talking about a lot of vacuum capacitors, a lot of high voltages, a lot of equipment. It really gets expensive in a hurry.
Hey, Mark, good news. I hope it's the right side. From your website, the WMIN page, is that, sure. Is that the right batch of pictures? Hey, Bert, go ahead and put some of those on and let Mark describe what we're looking at for each one.
Okay, I've got to bring up a browser to do that.
No, watch the Skype return. He'll show you there.
Okay.
Should be able to see it there. So, Burke, go ahead and toss some of those pictures on.
Switching computers. I'm in the process.
Wave that magic wand, Burke.
I sent the link over there to you, Burke.
So, Mark, this is Chris in New York. What stories can you tell us about late night calls of some I'll call them wacky engineering needs or something like squirrels in a tuning house or something that most folks who probably never see this stuff. I manage several directional arrays, so I'm accustomed to wild animals out in the field. But there's a lot of folks in the audience who are pretty much FMs on top of a building or a single tower, and they don't see much of this stuff. Any stories like that? Something crazy?
Well, I do have to tell you that years ago, I used to do all those things myself. I would go out and fix them. And now my goal is to be one level above that. In fact, I really am. So we've got the little guys out in the field, the guys who know a little bit about something. They can replace tube and transmitters, and they can kind of follow some directions on the phone. And then when they need the guy with the spectrum analyzer, me, then they call me, and then I go and help them. No particular stories come to mind at this moment, but if you give me a little time, I'll probably come up with something. There's always something. I do remember being at a radio station one time in my younger days, and there was I was getting everything all finished up and for the day, and I was all ready to leave, and all of a sudden, bang! There was a lightning strike on the tower. This was a non-directional AM and an FM. Well, I was planning on leaving about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I think I left there about midnight with most of everything running after that lightning strike.
Oh. Oh, wow. Did you have most of the parts on site, or is it one of those things you have to travel to far places to find a part here and there?
Well, I carry a lot of parts in my van, and I wrote an article in Radio World recently about that. And you might look at that. It's a Savannah, GMC Savannah, and it is absolutely loaded with equipment. Now, can I have everything in there? No. Can I put a lot of things in there? Absolutely, yes. So I can do a lot of repairs, even not being otherwise prepared. Like, they show up on site. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, we have a bad blah blah blah. Oh gosh, thanks a heap. Well, if you'd told me, I could have been sure to bring something. Well, anyway, the point is, the reason how my van got stocked was because I kept an inventory in my head of, well, last time or every time I go someplace, I figured, oh, now that I know that this is a part that might be used in the field, now I want to keep it with me so that the next time this happens, I can repair it while I'm there. Now,
yep.
Is that good for business? Well, it just makes me feel good that I can do these things. It doesn't mean that and the point is that I probably earn less money because of it, because I just show up and I perform a miracle and I leave, and everybody says, oh, okay, well, that's what it took, not knowing all that went on in the background there.
Hey, Mark, sometimes miracles are cheap and then sometimes they're not.
I used to do something similar, Mark. Whenever I'd replace a part at a radio station and I had to order it, I'd always order two. And sometimes I'd charge the client for like twice the price for the part because I bought it on my account, right?
And sure.
Then I'd stock myself with a part that I would then carry around for the next time I needed it.
Well, in today's financial climate, that's normal. That's, you're allowed to do that.
Yeah. Okay. If you're going to make, you have to make a profit in the business, and everyone has to understand that in order to stock parts, you have to charge extra for it. Paula passed me a note here that told that I of things I should tell you about, and it was a story I had written 30 years ago now for one of the trades, and it had to do with me working at a radio station until after midnight. And it was no big deal to me because I was young and handsome at the time and I could work until after midnight easily. And so there I am. I'm getting done and I have all this test equipment. I'm loading it into the van, okay, loading it in. And next thing you know, there's a light on a police car and stick up your hands, mister. And they stayed up like that for the next 20 minutes while the manager of the station got called out of bed, of course, to explain that I really was supposed to be there, thank you.
Ouch. That's happened to me, too, except I wasn't required to hold my hands up like that. The guy just says, what are you doing here? And I explained and, you know, used a bunch of technical gobbledygook, and he seemed satisfied and left. Have you ever run into a big wild animal?
No. But I ran into a big Frito-Lay truck one time. Well, no, I didn't. But I was at a station. I just happened to be there doing work one day. And I'm there and I'm walking around. And all of a sudden, the big CCA AM transmitter, 5 kilowatt, clunk. It just went down. And I thought, oh, gosh, well, it's a good thing I'm here. It's broke. So I'm pushing the on button and nothing's happening. And next thing you know, a guy shows up and he says, well, you want to come out and see something. So there it was. I went out to the parking lot, and there was a Frito-Lay truck, and they're big, and they carry all those potato chips in them, you know. Anyway, it's a really tall truck, and guess what? He was driving into the parking lot of the radio station to buy advertising, and he snagged a guy line on the main tower. It's a 3-tower directional array, and took the tower down. Now, nobody heard it in the building because it didn't fall on the building. So there I was.
Wow.
So then I'm going, oh, now what am I going to do? And it's late morning, and I thought, oh, my gosh. So I wound up hooking up the transmitter to the North Tower temporarily on the directional, ran them at a kilowatt. And I'm known to this day as the guy who got the radio station back on the air just in time for Paul Harvey.
Oh, that's true. I've worked at Paul Harvey stations.
That's important, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like having the TV station on in time for Oprah.
Oh, sure.
That's pretty much it.
Well, there's more to the story. As it turns out, the AM directional really was pointed in a direction where nobody lived anyway. And what happened was they got a nice insurance settlement out of the deal. And they decided to go non-directional. They did 90 watts at night, non-directional. Gave them actually better coverage in town than they ever had before because they didn't have any deep nulls. They used the money from the insurance settlement to build an FM. Of course, I built it.
You have the Frito-Lay van driver to thank for all that, right?
That's right. And everybody, it was a happy thing. Everybody was happy in the end, and that's how it came out.
Hey, I know this is mainly an audio podcast. That's how most of our listeners hear it. But, hey, we've got 1,000 of viewers right now. I want to see if Burke is ready to show these photos from the WMIN site. And there we go. Burke, can you zoom in any on any of those pictures? Is that possible? Can you do a little squeeze and stretchy thing there with your fingers? The pinch. There we go. All right, if you zoom in enough, you can see 7 towers in the first photo. Now, there's Mark in the second. Okay, there's the first photo with a bunch of towers. And the next photo down, Mark, what are you doing in the second photo down here?
No, I'm putting a module in a Nautel XR3 transmitter. No, an XR6, I think. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to ask you about that big honking cabinet.
That's a 3, but they also have a 6 on site. Ah. But go ahead.
And there's a cabinet behind you, but we'll scroll down. Now, what are you inside of here?
Okay, that's a phaser. It's a 4-tower directional for 10 kilohertz.
Wow, so the phaser takes the single power feed from the transmitter and divides it up amongst 4 towers, right?
That's right. That's right. And there are two patterns too. So each, so don't have to do the dividing twice, depending on what time of day it is. But you're right. That's just a small part of the system. And then, as you were alluding to in the next photo there, those are the filters between the antenna coupling network. After that,
Burke, scroll down to the next photo there. So these are the filters that keep the stations from interfering with each other.
Okay, so what you have, let's just take a simple example here of the box on the right-hand side. Now I have to remember, because it's been just a little while. Actually, the antenna coupling network for this particular station is in the center of the photo, flat on the back wall, and it's the aluminum plate there. Then that power goes over to this box. And this box has three filters in it, and I think it's got one in the lower cabinet, lower left-hand part of the cabinet. It has one detuning network for that tower for the frequency involved because of the two patterns. Once you let that frequency in through the three filters that are in the top and right-hand side of that cabinet, once you get it through there, then you have to do something with it. If you don't do something with it, you got to detune it if it doesn't happen to be used in, say, the night pattern or something like that. The point is that it took that much hardware for a radio station at a tower.
Wow, at a tower. So this next one, what are you on here? What is this about?
Oh, well, this was how we got around from tower to tower. It's, as some people know, good antenna systems are built on swamps. And guess what?
I know that.
This Argo will go through swamps. That's the plan.
Wow. So next one down, there's a gentleman that looks like he's playing with some cables. The next photo down, Burke.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's Tim. And he was terminating all of the sample lines that came in for one of the stations. I just wanted to put his picture in there because he was such a big part of the project. One of the many helpers and he's really good. He used to be a car mechanic, and he loves it. He works at the station, and they love him, and it worked out great.
You could take just a second and tell us what a sample line is. We haven't done a real extensive show on AM directional, so what does that mean?
Oh, okay. Well, when you send energy out to a tower, you have to figure out how much you sent there, and that's called ratioing it against the reference tower, probably the high power tower in the array. And then you have to figure out what phase relationship it's at, or adjust the phasor to get the right phase relationship so that you can get the directional pattern that you want. And the only way you know that you're doing, well, you have two ways that you know you're doing it right. One is you use those calibrated or those accurate samples back at a monitor to come up with, in the beginning, the theoretical numbers for the array. And then after that, and after you've tuned it up, you're out in the field there looking at the monitor points, the nulls in the pattern, and confirming that those measurements are low enough to meet FCC requirements. And then you go back to the antenna monitor and figure out if you're a few degrees off, and then you use those numbers for the ultimate license at the station.
Aha. Okay. All right. So sample lines, they have some requirements like that to be all kept at the same temperature or in the same environment so that if they change with temperature, they all change the same?
You're talking about the nuances of the whole thing. Yes. Let's say that one of your towers is 700 feet away and another one's only 300 feet away, but you want two identical length sample lines. Well, you don't take 400 feet of sample line and put it inside of the transmitter shack. You bury it in the ground just like the 700-foot line coming in from the far tower so that they all face the same environmental conditions.
Mm. Gotcha. Hey, Burke, can we scroll down a bit more? There's a next picture is a picture of a dummy load.
Otherwise known as an artificial antenna.
Oh, that's Mark Mueller in the picture there.
Okay. Oh, let's scroll down that one in just a minute. But there's a dummy load. That's what dissipating AM power is, heat.
Well, sure. Any good facility will have two transmitters, and you'll always want to, run one into a dummy load for testing while the other one's on the air, that kind of thing. And that's an FM dummy load. and it's 2.5 kilowatt load. And the point is that why can't it work for AM? It's an extra good load for AM. And you see what's in series with it? An ammeter. So I can meter current going into the dummy load. It's just a natural thing to do. That's my dummy load. I take it with me. It's actually their meter. But I take that out of the circuit, and what comes down to the bottom of the cabinet is just a piece of coaxial cable. So it's just one of those little tricks. And it's inexpensive for the client. All he paid for was a piece of coaxial cable. And then when I go to do some fixing, well, I brought my dummy load.
Yeah, there's no reason for every station you work on to have their own dummy load if you can carry one around, and that's part of your expert service. What's the next photo down there? I think we had a picture of Mark Mueller sitting in front of one of these filters.
Yep, that's Mark Mueller, and he's using his AIM-120 network analyzer and a notebook computer to figure out or to tune up another one of those filter setups. And a lot of capacitors. There he is tweaking on the phaser, and that was the 1010 kilohertz phaser. By the way, WMIN. Now, isn't that a great set of calls for a Minnesota radio station?
Sure.
They were given up by a station in Minneapolis because they thought they could come up with something better. And boy, were they snapped up in a hurry here. And this place is 70 miles from Minneapolis. They're really not a Minneapolis radio station. Well, we have all kinds of equipment on site. The next one. That's Herb. I didn't operate that one. I operated the Argo. Now, get a load of this. Isn't that a nice-looking transmitter site for the middle of nowhere in Minnesota?
Absolutely.
And it didn't take much to do that. And, oh, by the way, go back up if you would, please. Let me show you there. They're moving from one old building where there was two tightly packed radio stations to the new building, and they constructed a plywood walkway, and that's one of the phasers going down the walkway into the new building.
Wow. So they ended up reusing a lot of things from the old building then, yeah?
Absolutely. Why would you buy a new phaser? You're just moving it 30 feet.
Okay, so the parameters stayed the same?
Oh, sure. It's the same set of towers. We were just adding two more radio stations to the whole set.
Ah, all right. So what are we looking at here, this STL tower?
That is from the radio station's original tower when they were on 800 kilohertz back in the 1960s. And this leftover piece of tower, they're using it as an STL tower, a self-supporting STL tower. I think it's about 60 feet, something like that. Isn't that cool to reuse a piece of equipment that old? And, you know, if you were to go re-erect a tower. I think it started out as about 300-foot tower or something like that. If you were to reuse that, the insurance company would never let you do it if you wanted to go up that high. But if you're only talking 60 feet, it's just an STL tower. Who cares?
Yeah. Whoa, what's this piece of old gear?
Oh, that's an old ITA. Okay. It's an AM 250 watt transmitter. Some people called it intermittent transmitting apparatus.
Okay.
Actually, it turned out to be an extremely reliable piece of equipment, and that was from the original station on 800 kilohertz back from the 1960s. And look at that. Actually, it was a kilowatt transmitter, but they ran it at 250 watts. It never broke.
It had all kinds of headroom then, didn't it?
Oh, sure. We wound up retuning it a couple times to be on new frequencies along the way. And it almost darn near wound up back on its original frequency, but not quite, because that isn't how everything fell together.
So that last picture we were about to look at, what is that?
Oh, on the right, that's a Gates BC1G transmitter. Oh. And that they bought used, and this is on the 800 kilohertz station. And the interesting part is, when I was in high school at age 16 or so, I installed a brand new one of those. And that's only in Brainerd, Minnesota. Sorry. And you laugh when I say that. That was 1964. It was the latest and greatest at the time.
Wow. Mark, you're older than you look, apparently, if you installed one new in 1964.
Yeah. But I was still in high school at the time. But it was a great experience. And I think that really propelled me into making sure that I really, really, really wanted to be a broadcast engineer.
We're going to continue our conversation with Mark Persons in just a minute. In fact, we're going to turn the conversation to the subject of where are the new engineers going to come from? Because we're just not seeing so many of them.
Our show continues in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about our sponsor, which is Telos and the Telos HX series of telephone hybrids. These are POTS telephone hybrids. They connect to a plain old analog telephone line. But you can also connect them to any VoIP adapter, you know, like a Vonage adapter or a Magic Jack. Wherever you have a POTS or POTS type of connection, you can connect an HX1 or an HX2, which gives you two phone lines, a digital hybrid from Telos. Now, what does a hybrid do? Well, it's the right way to connect a telephone line to broadcast equipment. So if you're a podcaster, if you have a small radio station or a big radio station, maybe you have a production studio, maybe you make commercials or music, or you just do interviews, whatever it is that involves phone lines and at least as good quality audio as you can possibly get out of that phone line, that's where you need a hybrid. And, you know, Telos invented the digital hybrid. Years ago, Steve Church invented the very first digital telephone hybrid. And the HX series of hybrids carries that tradition on. Now, the HX series of hybrids, we have the HX1 and the HX2. That's a single line and a dual line hybrid. These are really value priced. I mean, they are, we've been able to keep the cost down with some truly innovative digital DSP technology. You can also get them in an AES input and output. Now, they come standard with an analog in and out, and for just a little bit more money, you can have AES digital in and out if that's what you need as well. But either way, you connect to a POTS telephone line. And there are also dip switch options to allow you to connect to POTS lines all over the world. So no matter what country you're listening to this podcast in, you can get a digital Telos hybrid, HX1 or HX2, and set it for the loop current, the ring voltage, the characteristics that are particular to your particular country and the POTS phone system in that country. Hey, these hybrids are full of all kinds of features. Inside the single hybrid HX1 and the dual hybrid HX2, you're going to find advanced hybrid technology with new features that sweetens and controls caller audio better than ever before. There's Omnia processing, and that it intuitively manages levels and EQ. There's extra DSP power, so even unruly mobile phone audio is brought into submission, and those tricky VoIP lines as well. Power supply is internal. New features like built-in auto answer, caller disconnect detection, ingenious auto leveling and anti-feedback routines for enhanced open speaker applications. So, hey, even if you're doing a TV show, you can still take callers and have the caller on an open speaker in the studio and feed open mic to the caller so the caller can hear you. There's front panel line hold features and send and receive audio metering. They're all standard on the HX1 and the HX2. You want to find out more? It's easy. Go to the website. Point your browser to Telos. That's TELOS, telos-systems.com/HX. All right, telos-systems.com/HX, and you'll read all about it. And contact your favorite Telos dealer if you want to get one for yourself. Very glad to have Telos and the HX series of hybrids sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech.
And we're back on This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, and along with me are two of my regular co-hosts, Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, and Chris Tobin from New York City, Manhattan.
Yeah.
And our guest today,
hello,
Chris, our guest today is Mark Persons. Now, Mark has been a contract engineer for a long, long time, and I had the pleasure of meeting Mark over 20 years ago at an NAB show, and you know, kind of keep in touch with him every now and then, and I've gotten a lot of good advice from Mark. Love his articles. He writes articles usually in Radio World. And so anyway, Mark's with us. And the next thing we're going to talk about, Mark, something that was kind of near and dear to your heart, and that is, where's the next group of engineers going to come from to take care of and fix terrestrial radio stations?
Well, you got me. I mean, it's a tough one. It really is. I mean, I've been looking for that person somewhere out there. And the truth is, I don't have any competition. I can go 300 miles almost, and there's nobody out there. It's a bad story. You'd think that there'd be some young guy who'd want to stick around the radio stations like what used to happen. And they'd say, oh, can I see what's going on? Can I help you? Can I learn? That kind of thing. It's not happening. And so I don't know who's going to replace me. The only thing I can hope for is a terrestrial radio will go away and be replaced by the internet. That's my best hope at this time.
Well, your hope's probably not too far from reality. Let's check in with Chris Tobin in New York City. Chris, I know that there's a couple of younger engineers in the New York City area. I think one of our usual co-hosts, Tom Ray, has hired one of them recently. But Chris, what about around your place at CBS or other stations that you've worked at or people you know? Do you see young engineers coming along?
Sadly, no. The young folks, if you will, the younger set are more computer oriented. The black magic of broadcasting, whether it be FM or AM, just doesn't seem to interest a lot. I've had a few folks come by for tours and see the place and ask questions. And one or two folks have called me and said, hey, I got in. I'm doing some stuff locally in my community at the radio station, and I'm thinking of continuing on. But not as often as it used to be, say, 10, 15 years ago. Yes, and Tom did hire a young man who is very good, knows his stuff, and is learning very well. And I've had an opportunity to work with him on several occasions, and he's definitely got the chops for what needs to be for broadcast engineering. But yeah, two things working against all of us in the community. One, most of the radio stations, many radio stations in markets where you could probably, if you say, have a farm team developing, aren't willing to pay, because technology today is so easy to use in your home. You sort of translate that ease of use to your office, your business, and say, why do I need to pay such high numbers? If I can do this at home, why can't it be done here at the same price or less? I've run into that. I've actually had folks call me up for help, and I give them a rate card, and they're like, what? I was like, well, the guy who you had here was working at the 7-Eleven, and he was trying to get through school, and you put him at your transmitter. That 10,000-watt transmitter is now running in a very, very strange out-of-parameter method, which I don't think the FCC would like, nor would you enjoy your power bill and everything else that's going the wrong way. But again, that particular manager started equating his technical needs to what he does at home. And I sat there going, wow, how do you discuss something with somebody who's fixated on that's the way things are now? 20 years ago, it was people like, oh, yeah, okay, you know what, you're worth it. That's right, it makes sense, go do it. So the younger folk who are looking to do something and inquire, they don't get much feedback from those folks saying it's a positive thing. It's sad, but true. I mean, I'm sure, Mark's area is probably even more sparse because of, just being out where he is. Here in the city, there's not many folks knocking on the doors. And I've put out feelers for part-time help on occasion, and nothing has come back in the last 6 months. It's getting really dry.
Oh, well. Mark, have you ever, do you always work by yourself, or do you ever hire people as interns or people to help you pull cable, or are you schooling anybody along to take over your stations after you?
Well, that's a tough one. I have people at the radio stations help me what I do, and that's fine for what it is. But my question to anyone who is even mildly interested in this is, okay, Ohm's Law. You know Ohm's Law, right? What's Ohm's Law? Well, if you don't know Ohm's Law, how are you going to even think about thinking your way through a troubleshooting exercise in a transmitter? How is this going to happen? I mean, you could go in and replace every part. And that brings up the other side of the whole thing. We're kind of in a throwaway world. Something goes wrong. It's a $200 device. You throw it away. Big deal. It's gone. Well, what do you do with a $60,000 transmitter? It breaks. And then what are you going to do? Throw it away?
Yeah. You're not going to throw it away. You got to keep fixing the thing. Well, the ITA transmitter you showed there was from 1964. It still works, right?
Oh, absolutely. And now it's taken a few repairs over the years to keep it running, but it's still a fine piece of equipment. Now, there are some other newer transmitters that are junk today just because they deserve to be that way because they weren't really well designed, but that's an entirely different story. But yeah. I can't think of a transmitter that was retired in less than, 20 years of service, and a lot of the transmitters I work in have been around for 40 years or more, and some of them are in mainline service with no backups. We're kind of in a, you know, kind of a, I hate to say Minnesota is backwoods. Yeah, sure, you betcha.
But some parts, sure. Hey, Mr. Tarr, you have something to add on this. What you got?
Well, you know, we're talking about, you know, where you're finding engineers. And for an example, I hired a guy who actually worked with Mark up at KVSC, Tony Ebfalter, who is I brought in and, you know, had some experience as an assistant, not really any full-time experience, but I brought him in and was one of those guys that I talked to him and really understood that he got it. He knew what was going on. And so in that way, I kind of rolled our own in terms of an engineer. I brought in a guy who, you know, had some experience with transmitters and you know, had some experience enough where I wasn't concerned where he was going to hurt himself or anything. And then over the past few years, I've kind of been teaching him. And, he was when I first hired him, early 20s. And, you know, got him in a position where, you know, he's pretty well rolling on his own. And I think we're going to see a lot of that because there really is no training programs anymore for these guys coming in. And so it's going to have to be a situation where, you know, you try to find some people who just have a natural talent for those sorts of things. And grow them yourself. And, you know, I know at least at Intercom, we have several markets that actually have training programs for engineering where they, you know, they actually have a program where they'll bring a person in and they'll start to train them. And, you know, as they get better and better, they kind of go into a kind of, you know, the minor league team where or the farm team where we can, you know, we kind of have this stable of people that we can bring through the ranks. I think you're going to see a lot more of that as time goes on. But it's tough because there's really no real good entry level there. There, you know, used to be school or military where people would learn these things, and that's not there anymore. So it's kind of up to us to train the next generation. You know, the other side to what Mark was talking about with having to repair older transmitters and the Ohm's Law and the Throwaway Society is that things have become a lot more modular. So, you know, as time goes on and these new transmitters go in, You're not going to need to know as much component level troubleshooting as you'd have to know in the past, because although the transmitter is $20,000, the board that goes bad is $100. And, you know, while I try to still go to component level, you know, you could easily, you know, send that in and have it repaired and turned around fairly inexpensively, probably cheaper than what you pay a guy to come in and actually go through the entire thing. So
that's a good point. Yeah. You know, that ITA transmitter that Mark showed, that's something that you always repair to the component level. I mean, there probably aren't sub-assemblies in there that you'd want to replace a whole. And of course, you couldn't get them now anymore anyway. Mark, what's your take on that? On you know, if you like, think about one of the newer. I'll pick out Nautel. One of the newer Nautel transmitters or FM exciters that's built with surface mount componentry inside for the lower level stages. What are you going to do about that? Do you replace whole boards? What's your level of digging into a repair?
Well, you're absolutely correct. The manufacturers are building them to suit the audience that they're getting into. And that audience is people who don't understand. So they're making them with plug-in cards, or they go back to the factory. And quite frankly, what I have here is quite a few people sending me things for repair, modulation monitors, older audio processors, you name it. And then I fix them on the bench because there's almost no one in the field who knows anything about component level troubleshooting. So, and I can see where manufacturers are coming from, especially in Nautel. They're doing an excellent job of building them modular so that they can be fixed that way in the field. Let me give you a quick tip or a story here. I was at a radio broadcast site that happened to be a cellular site at the same time. And I was there working, and one of the cell guys was there. And I says, hey, I says, my soldering iron's giving me trouble. Loan me your soldering iron. And he says, oh, we don't have soldering irons. All we're allowed to do is plug in cards.
Yeah,
well, you know, I think that there's, you know, not you're right about, you know, they're playing to their audience. But it's not even guys who can't component level troubleshoot, because I can. There are guys like me who have six radio stations that I've got to worry about. And as much as I'd love to go tear apart that modulation monitor, it's almost as effective to send it to a guy like you to have it fixed and sent back. So, yeah, I think there's a balance there. And, you know, there's obviously there are easy repairs and there are hard repairs. And I think what's going on is we're starting to go through that kind of process in troubleshooting almost, where I'll take a look at something and go, is it worth my time to go in component level troubleshoot this? Or is there somewhere where I can send it? Or is there something else I can do that will, balance out that time versus money ratio? Because if I'm tied up all afternoon working on something like a modulation monitor that may not be critical to the operation of the radio station, that could be a time waster for me in terms of, the 800 other things that I have on my list to do. So I think there's a couple of things at play there like that.
Well, and the other thing, this morning, guess what? The phone rang at 5 a.m. Local engineer, young guy, a transmitter was tripping. This is a Continental 20 kilowatt FM transmitter, and it was tripping the screen breaker. And I said, well, it's probably the tube. Why don't you put a tube in? So he's trained enough to do that. Okay, so he puts another tube in, same results. He had about just a couple percent of power. Okay, so I said, all right, well, and as it turns out, in that case, they were okay until I got there around 9 o'clock. And then I got there, and gosh, what was it? Well, it was a diode in the screen voltage power supply. So he couldn't have found that. It took me to find that and replace it.
Kind of reminds me of the joke about the guy who fixed something expensive and handed over a huge bill. He said, well, that didn't take you 15 minutes to fix this thing. Said, well, it might, is your time that much? No, my time's not worth that much. It's my knowledge. I knew exactly where to go, and nobody else did. That's one thing you'll find about Mark and other experienced contract engineers and station engineers too. Who have a sense of a pretty quick sense of how things work. It's not just a box that you don't understand. It's something that you become, after you've been in there a couple of times, you become familiar with what all the circuits do and a bit about how they work. And Mark didn't take you long at all to find that first of all, the screen voltage power supply had a problem, and then trace that down to a bad diode.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, I was going to say, one of the other things about troubleshooting on the other side of that is I actually know when I could set aside the time, because it is actually very enjoyable to me to go through and trace these things down. And it's very rewarding when you actually, when you fix these things and you get them running again. So, there's something to be said about that, too, or as much as I'm in a hurry sometimes to get things done and tend to the 800 other things on my list. There are times when I will find myself fortunate I can clear enough time to actually sit down and, go through and repair something like that step by step at the component level, because it's I definitely think that if you don't learn those sorts of skills, that you're missing out for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was another one of those instances where I had a screen voltage rectifier stack in my car. and along the way, I went to the supply room here and picked up it was a 15 microfarad 2000 volt capacitor, and just in case that had been the problem. And I also picked up a feed through capacitor for the power amplifier, just in case that had been the problem. Well, as it turns out, it was just a diode. But the point is that I went there prepared, knowing ahead of time that we had a screen voltage problem.
Yeah. And we actually did a show some time ago, a little bit, where we covered tubes. We covered what these different things do. The screen voltage, isn't that kind of like a little accelerator or booster? In other words, if it's a tetrode tube and the screen voltage dies, the first symptom is very, very low power output.
Very, very low, emission, right? And, there was one more story that Paula handed me that I've got to tell you about. This is back when I still had brown hair. And you remember when satellites were brand new? NBC, CBS, ABC, they all used those original, what the heck were they? Not the Comtech ones, but the ones that were supplied by the networks. That goes back to, the late 1970s. Does anyone know that name?
The satellite receivers?
Satellite receivers, yeah.
You had Fairchild, and you had Scientific Atlanta.
Begner. The SA. Okay. Wait a minute. Yeah, one of them had a down converter that sat out at the dish.
Yes,
and it that was would be a, Fairchild. Was a, Yeah, and the Fairchild. Yeah, and it was a gold colored box. It was a long, more than a foot long and 6 inches by 8 inches, something like that. And it took the LNA output and converted it to some kind of an IF, like 70 megahertz or something like that. So I put one of these things in brand new and did it just the way the instructions were, and that is to put the down converter out at the dish. And then there was this cold winter day in Minnesota, and it was at least 40 below zero that night. And I get a call. The satellite receiver has quit. And I'm thinking, oh, no, now what am I going to do? So I get in the vehicle, and I'm driving down the street, and this is the funny part of the story, and the steering wheel on the car starts to get tighter and tighter as I'm driving down the street. This is non-power assisted steering on the car. So I got to the radio station. Fortunately, it was right in town. And I came in out of the cold. It was better than, little more than 40 degrees below zero. And I came in and I said, well, I better pull the book out to warm up while I warm up my hands and that kind of thing. So I open the book and it flaps open to the specifications on the front panel, on the front page. And it said the equipment is good to 40 below zero. And I thought, I wonder what that means. So what I did was I grabbed a piece of carpeting, ran outside where the dish was, wrapped it around the low noise, the down converter, took my trouble light out of the car, hung it just below that, and came back inside. And about the time I was starting to warm up again, the down converter warmed up enough to start running again.
Problem solved.
Love it.
Problem solved. Yeah, and to think that the you just described that down converter as such a huge box, and now they put all that in a much more phase-stable assembly all at the dish.
Oh yeah,
that's
the 70 megs.
And yeah, and they're so much better too, by the way, if you look at them. So and anyway, it was just a funny story, and it's a Minnesota story. It is unlikely to happen in places like Alabama, by the way.
Hey, guys, actually, we're going to have to draw our show to a close here pretty soon. I wish we could go on and on, but I've been advised by the network that we need to wrap the show up. So we're going to do that in short order. Mark, I have just thoroughly enjoyed having you on. I hope I speak for Chris and Chris. Like to have you back on again. We're going to pick maybe a real specific topic and have you maybe do some explaining to us about what you do out in the field and certain situations you found. In fact, we have a War Stories episode every 10 episodes. Maybe we could have you back for a War Stories episode about your experiences in the trenches.
I'd love to do that. And meanwhile, I'm going to practice looking at the camera, which isn't easy for me right now. So,
all right. Hey, joining us on this episode with Mark Persons have been Chris Tobin from New York. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, welcome, Kurt. No problem. Thanks, Mark.
And from Mukwonago, Wisconsin, Chris Tarr. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Thanks for having me. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, The Geek Jedi, and go Packers.
All right.
Okay.
And Mark Persons is at mwpersons.com. Mark, thanks for being with us, too. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Glad I could do it.
And we'll have a show notes. If you go to the website at thisweekinradiotech.com, we'll put the link in the show notes for the webpage that we showed to the viewing audience so you can follow along at home with your audio version of the podcast. And see the pictures that we were talking about. We'll put that in the show notes. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. It'll come to your iTunes player, a client, automatically, or use the RSS feed that's on the website. And that website, again, is thisweekinradiotech.com. And we'll be back next week with another This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This episode of This Week in Radio Tech has been brought to you by Telos and the new Telos HX digital hybrids, including the HX1 and HX2. Check them on the web at telos-systems.com/HX.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.